Okay, so, again, I told you how homomorphisms from between powers of U via the PBW theorem become power series in Greek and Latin letters. I told you how to compose such power series if they were perturbed Gaussians. And the main ingredient that's missing is to tell you that everything around SL2 plus epsilon really is a perturbed Gaussian. Okay? So, most of it is very easy. Small parts of it are just easy, but not very easy. So, let's start.
How difficult is easy?
One box in a handout. Okay? Okay? So, the first statement is that it's really enough. So, you know, if L is an operator from QZA to QZB, well, the only thing I want is linear. Or really, I actually want some convergence. But, I mean, the main thing I want is linear. Then D of L, so the differential operator corresponding to L, and it should be an operator in, it should be a function of the zeta A's and the ZB's, is simply L applied to the identity element. So L applied to the exponential of zeta I zi, and so you see, let's interpret this. So if you write this as a power series, then you get zeta zi's with coefficients that are zetas. The zi's, so I runs in A, so the zi's are elements here, so you can apply L and you consider the corresponding zetas as coefficients. And then the result depends on the zetas, which are in A, and the z's become z, the z's become zb's. So the result depends on zetas of the A type and z's of the B type, and hence it's the right result. It's the right form of the result. Now, of course, I have to prove this.
Sorry, linear meaning ZA goes to ZB linearly, or the whole thing is linear?
No, the whole thing is linear.
Okay.
So, probably need some topological.
But a priori, then this D of L is some horror story, right? Before L is sufficiently complicated.
Yeah, yeah. The D of L is in general a horror story. Mm-hmm. But my claim is that it's easy to compute it. All you have to do. So essentially, what I'm telling you is that D of L is a generating function, right? If you expand this, you get all possible combinations of the zi's, and then when you compute L of it, it's basically a generating function. Well, that's all. Okay. So I don't know. Here I wrote that the proof is an exercise. If you will challenge me, I will try to do the exercise. I'm not sure.
No, I think it's in some ways obvious.
Okay, fine. Good. So now I have to give you examples. So basically, examples, and I'll start
with trivial examples, and it will get more complicated, okay? So first of all, the classical coproduct going from the classical algebra to the tensor I, so basically it means one tensor factor named I, to the classical algebra named squared, but really it means two tensor factors named J and K. So first of all, this coproduct is given by, well, if you apply it, if you apply the this coproduct to yi, bi, ai, and xi, the result is, well, yi, so basically all elements are primitive. That's the meaning of being in the algebra, or I mean, that's the coproduct of the universal developing algebra. So yi goes to yj plus yk, bi goes to bj plus bk, and so on. Okay? So then, the differential so to compute the differential operator corresponding to it, I apply it to the exponential, and then the Greek letters are not participating, I mean, delta only applies to the Latin letters. So yi becomes yj plus yk, bi becomes bj plus bk, and so on. So the differential operator corresponding to the coproduct is written here, the classical coproduct is written here, and I don't know, it depends on the right set of variables, so Greek variables for the inputs and Latin variables for the outputs, and it's a perturbed, well, it's in fact not even perturbed, it's a Gaussian, and in fact, you know, of the class of Gaussians that I was talking about, so Dopendo had things that had omega, had cross terms, had Greek terms, Latin terms, and perturbation terms. In our case, there is only the cross terms. So omega is equal to 1, so this is 1, these are 0, and there is no perturbation. Okay? So it's the easiest case possible, but well, it's a very easy example. Okay, next. So that was the coproduct. Now let's do the product. Okay? But I could do, so the product of Cu is non-commutative and it will take some effort, and in fact it's the next example. So let's start with something even simpler, namely just a commutative product. Okay? So a commutative product, so suppose I wanted to find the tensor corresponding to Mijk, which is the product from the polynomial ring, sorry, the power series ring in tensor factor I, tensor, the power series ring in tensor factor J, and I want to multiply them and put the result in tensor factor K. Okay? So first of all, this is simply the power series ring in ZIZJ, and, well, this is just the power series ring in ZK, and the product is simply the evaluation which maps ZI to ZK and ZJ to ZK, maps both ZI and ZJ to ZK. Okay? So, the corresponding differential operator should have, or Gaussian differential operator, should have inputs corresponding to I and J, so Greek I, so zeta I and zeta J, and outputs ZK, so it should depend on zeta I, zeta J, and zeta K, and if you want to compute it, sorry, and ZK, if you want to compute it, all you have to do is to simply apply the multiplication to e to the zeta I zi, e to the zeta j zj. That's the lemma. Okay? But Well, if you apply multiplication to this, both zi and zj become zk, so the overall result is written here. And once again, it's a Gaussian, it's a perturbed Gaussian differential operator of the stupidest kind. Namely, there is only a cross term. So if everything will remain this way, then I've wasted a lot of energy about telling you about perturbed things and about like loopback terms, etc. But not everything remains that way. Okay? So here is the first real example. The first example where things get complicated. Okay? So let's compute the classical multiplication tensor going from CUI tensor CUJ, so the classical algebra in tensor factor I, tensor the classical algebra in tensor factor J, into CUK. And remember that the way we do it is by first applying the PBW theorem. So we have, so let OI be the PBW ordering map.
What's your definition of, do you choose some ordering? Or
the ordering is always YBAX, YBAX.
Oh. Young Baxter.
Yeah, well, Roland, yeah, Young Baxter, but any other ordering would work. You'd get different formulas, but the same result overall. And in fact, we played with other orderings as well. There's nothing holy about the order. Okay? And again, the reordering maps are themselves dopegdo. So there really is nothing holy about the ordering. Okay? So let OI be the ordering map, which maps from power series in the YBAX variables into the classical algebra by simply ordering them in the YBAX order. Okay? So then I have an OIJ map. Sorry. An OIJ map which orders two copies of the classical algebra. So it goes from power series in YBAX I and YBAX J into CUI tensor CUJ. And there is the OK ordering map written here. And really, and the operator I am trying to represent as a differential operator is the operator going this way. Okay? So, claim, if lambda is the following ugly expression, then e to the lambda represents the operator written above, which amounts to saying that if you start with the identity on the input side, so again, eta I, y I, beta I, b I, and so on up to psi j, x j, map it to up here, apply the classical multiplication, and apply OK inverse, you get e to the lambda, or the way I wrote it, you get, you know, you put the OK inverse to the right hand side, so you get e to the lambda followed by OK. Okay? Okay? So, maybe before proving this, let me note that this makes the classical multiplication dopegdo. Because if you look at this expression, you see that it has quadratic parts. So eta i's times, so here is an eta I times a y k. The the if you expand it in epsilon, you get a power series, right? The 1 plus epsilon eta j psi I becomes a power series in epsilon, and the coefficient of epsilon to the k is going to be some higher power of eta of eta j psi I, but it satisfies, it's bound, so basically for every epsilon you get two Greek letters plus two more letters outside, so you get overall 2k plus 2 letters. Now, there are further coefficients, namely, there are the alpha i's, so okay, this epsilon terms is good because, I mean, it has epsilons, you know, if you have powers of epsilons, it's all right, but it's okay that they're accompanied by Greek or Latin letters. But this alpha I is not accompanied by a power of epsilon, but that goes into the footnotes. In the footnotes of the definition for the pegdo, I actually allowed that weight zero variables will come are not bound by the docility condition, and so that's okay. Okay?
That's probably we would need to. Perhaps you would need to explain how is it okay, right?
I would. Mm-hmm. So in a sense, I would have to go through a second run through the talk. Mm-hmm. And I'm sure you don't want me to do it, but in principle, I should go through a second run through the talk in which I take care of every footnote, in which the footnotes are considered. Okay? So anyway, I mean, likewise, each of the other terms. So each of the other terms, if you think about it, is obeys the dependent conditions. Okay?
Let's say everything is very good except for those exponentials, right? That's
Yes. I would have to go again and explain why. Good. So I still have to prove this identity. Right? It looks messy, right? So, there are several proofs, but one proof is to actually use representation theory. But I'm using only one representation, not a tensor power of representations. I mean, I don't get into any serious. I mean, the issues I have with representation theory do not apply here. So, first of all, you find a two-dimensional representation rho of the classical algebra, and so rho y is 0, 0, epsilon, 0. Rho b is 0, 0, minus epsilon. Rho a is this, rho x is this. And in fact, this is already written in computer code. So I ask the computer to highlight, is rho a times rho x minus rho x times rho a equal to rho x? So basically, I'm asking the computer to highlight the results of all the comparisons that make up the commutation relations of CU. And the computer dutifully highlights all of them and says that they're true. Okay? So this really is a representation of CU. Okay? And now, the identity written here, I simply apply the representation. Well, you can check that the representation is faithful. So if it's true in the representation, it's true. So, but what is the... what is the right-hand side? So when you order this in Weibach's order, this becomes e to the eta y times e to the beta b times e to the alpha a. I wrote stuff already in Weibach's order. Okay? But e to the eta y is simply the exponential in the representation. It's the exponential of eta times the representative of y. So I declare that E stands for matrix exponentiation, and I compute eta of rho y, of eta y times rho y, times eta of beta I times the representation of V. So basically I compute the left-hand side, and it's a product of 8 things. So two things in Y-box order, one from here to here, multiplied by, sorry, four things given in right Y-box, oh, sorry, four factors corresponding to the I factor, and then since I classically multiply by the J factor, I get the other four factors from the J factor, and I want to check if this agrees with the right-hand side. Now, what's the right-hand side? So, the right-hand side should be e to the lambda order. So, the Latin letters in lambda appear only here. There is a Y, a B, an A, and an X. All the rest are coefficients, are actually Greek letter coefficients. So I need to check, so doing e to the lambda OK just means, and then representing, just means that you exponentiate this times the exponent of that, the exponential of that times the exponential of that times the exponential of that. But this is simply e to the y, or e to a coefficient times y, and the coefficient is the derivative of lambda with respect to y. So here it is. I exponentiate the derivative with respect to y of lambda multiplied by rho y. The derivative with respect to b of lambda multiplied by rho b, and so on. So that's all I need to check, right? I need to check some simple-minded matrix identity. If I had a mind, I would have done it myself. But since I don't have a mind, but I do own a computer, I type it in, I hit enter, and the computer tells me that it's true. Okay? But if you want to know the truth, I mean, how did we find this identity? Also, not by having a mind, but rather by having a computer. So namely, some identity like that we expected should hold, and we found it by, instead of putting here, basically by putting here undetermined coefficients and solving for these coefficients. Okay, so you solve a system of equations, you find what the coefficients are, and you get lambda. Okay? Unfortunately, and then the one last thing, I had, you know, again, since I don't have a mind, but I have a computer, I wanted to check if lambda is Dopedo, so I'm computing this the power series expansion of lambda with respect to epsilon up to power 1. I could have done it to power 5 just as well. And if you look at it, so the part which is independent of epsilon is the Gaussian, and it is, or it is at least, if you allow the footnotes. And then the part, sorry, this is from here to here, and then the part that is proportional to epsilon is a perturbation polynomial, but the degree of the, or but the weight is always less than 4.
Sorry, but even before, how is it even, besides those exponentials, what about this bk, f, j, psi I?
Sorry?
This doesn't look like Gaussian, right?
Bk,
bk times theta. Yeah.
So b is a weight zero variable. So b is a scalar for the purpose of this calculation.
So b and alpha, both.
Yes.
Okay, but that I fear we'll have to go there in more detail, right? Because, okay, now you basically have some arbitrary thing, right? It has exponentials, it has higher degree polynomials, you still say it's a Gaussian. Good, but, okay, I believe you. To me, it does not look like a Gaussian.
So, Okay. Mm-hmm. So I'll go back to it in a moment. Mm-hmm. Okay. But maybe I should say that the same technique fails for the quantum algebra. So so basically, well, okay, I shouldn't, maybe I shouldn't get into it, but we'll have to do something else to figure out the multiplication tensor in the quantum algebra. Okay? So now to answer, maybe I should go back why is my mouse, why does my mouse keep dying? Anyway, okay. So, yeah. So now let's go through the real definition of Doppetto. Okay. So, okay. First of all, yeah. So let's start with the footnotes here. So each variable has, the footnotes are on your handout. I don't know if I should put them on the board just to make it for easier comparisons. But each variable should have a weight. So this is, I think, the first footnote. And the weight of every dual pair adds up to 2. So basically, if z is of weight 1, then zeta is also of weight 1, and then duality interchanges weights for 2 and 0. Okay? I imagine that if we had worked with higher Lie algebras, we would have to allow higher weights, but we're not there yet. Okay? The next footnote. So the objects were finite sets, but really it should be graded finite sets. So sets that are decomposed into the weight 0 part, the weight 1 part, and the weight 2 part. Okay? Next, omega is a scalar. But when I say scalar, I really allow power series in the weight zero variables. Okay? Later I will have to, in a minute, I will have to explain why the compositions preserve this. Okay? Q is a small quadratic. I want it to be of weight 2. So basically, weight 1 variables pair with weight 1 variables, and weight 0 pair with weight 2. Okay? And what's the next footnote? So the degree of pk should be at most 2k plus 2. So really, I mean the weight of pk. So different variables have different weights. In particular, weight zero variables are not constrained. They can be any power series. And what was footnote number 6? I forget.
Union is a product.
Footnote number 6 was to say that there are morphisms, but there are also obvious. There are also products of you can compose Gaussians, but you can also multiply them. So, there are compositions of morphisms, but there is also simple multiplication of morphisms. And I used it implicitly before, but okay, so that's not really one of the weight issues. This is a different issue. Okay, so now. So now a more correct picture is the following.
How should they do that?
So the problem is that it's also much more complicated.
So if they don't care about very zero variables, right? So then everything counts. Weight one variables, everything works nicely.
Yeah, for now, weight one variables are perfect. Right. Yeah.
Now, right, the question is, how does it look?
So you know, maybe I should not write it in a square with inputs and outputs, but just more abstractly. So basically, the things I'm allowed to have are quadratics with weight one on both ends, and then the coefficients are scalars. So if I wanted to draw them as lines, they would be straight lines.
No, the coefficients can be weight zero functions or arbitrary functions of weight zero.
Oh, sorry, I stand corrected. So the coefficients are, let's write it like this, they are things of weight zero. Okay? Then there are the other part of the quadratic. So the other part of the quadratic are things which have weight zero on one end, weight two on the other end, and here the coefficients are scalars. Sorry, I was confused. So,
you can also add whatever you want.
Because I didn't read the footnotes in full. So the weight of Q must be two. So you can decompose it as a 2-0 part and a 1-1 part. Mm-hmm. And the coefficients of the 2-0 part are rational numbers, straight numbers, okay? Mm-hmm. While the coefficients of the 1-1 part can be made in weight 0 power series. Mm-hmm. Okay? So really, so this is how my quadratic looks like. Mm-hmm. Okay? And And then the way I do compositions or Gaussian integrations or zipping, I mean, is by doing it in two steps. Okay? So first of all, I do it, or in fact it commutes, I can do it in either order. So you know what, let's do the one part first. So I mean, this is sort of the Q11 part, and this is the Q20 part. So you first deal with the Q11 part. So you first do all the 1-1 gluings. Okay? And when you deal with the 1-1 gluings, you simply treat these as part of the power as the coefficient ring. Okay, so there is no problem. It's the same arguments as the same explanations as before work. So basically, you know, you have things that look like this. Okay? But still, I mean, instead of rational coefficients, you get power series coefficients. But the same operations work. And then you do the 0-2 gluings. The 0-2 gluings for the quadratic part work perfectly fine, because the coefficients are rational numbers. So the quadratic parts work just as well. But from the perspective of Q20, you treat the Q11 part as if it was a perturbation. Okay? And what it amounts to is that to each zero end here, well, the gluing is with is of things with opposite weights. So to each zero end here, you glue a 2-0 strut from here, and then possibly another one. So possibly you get a geometric series of such struts. But at the end, you come back to where you started, namely a polluted 1-1 strut. So polluted by things with weight zero ends.
So that's it.
It's amazing, by the way, how hard it is to explain this to humans, and how hard was it to come up to realize that it works, as opposed to how relatively easy it is to explain it to computers. So computers just don't care, they just do. Sorry, I mean, that's an aside. But basically, I just told you the key point. So basically, instead of doing Gaussian integration or Gaussian differentiation in one step, you do it in two steps. You first do the 1-1 gluing and everything is kosher, and then you do the 0-2 gluings and everything is kosher for them, and for their from their perspective, these are just perturbations. And they, but doing the 2-0 gluings to the perturbations still keeps them as Gaussians from the 1-1 perspective.
So can you reformulate it in the following way? So before we were saying that we were computing some kind of Gaussian integrals, right?
Yeah.
Now you're saying, okay, you know, similar to how you knew before how to compute Gaussian integrals, I now tell you how to compute not arbitrary but very sophisticated integrals. Could you state your lemma, calculation lemma, in terms of what are the integrals that you're now able to compute?
So right? I tried a little bit and didn't get to a good answer. I mean, I did look for such a
please, you agree? It's kind of
okay.
The must kind of
there must be precedents.
Yeah.
I'm looking. You're right. I am looking for precedents. So I mean, there must be some quantum field theories.
Not even right? Four quantum field theories, but
in
what
which you have d. Let me still. Yeah. You know. D phi d c bar, okay, and somehow the Lagrangian is such that it is quadratic from the perspective of the phi's, if you regard the c's as coefficients, and it is simply quadratic absolutely from the perspective of c and c bar. I'm looking for such examples.
I'm asking, okay, that's also a valid question, but I'm asking about a different thing. So right, even let's forget quantum field theory, find it dimensionally, right? You're now telling us that besides Gaussian integrals that we know how to compute, there is another class of integrals that we also know how to compute. And probably, I imagine maybe it's not that difficult, or maybe it is difficult. So what are those, right? Because now with those arbitrary functions of weight zero variables, right, you're also computing.
I tried a little bit. My answer is, I tried for an hour once,
mm-hmm.
and could not write something that made me happy.
But your prescription, it should be equivalent to some integration.
In principle, all I have to do is to take our examples and apply to them sort of this trick, and then it's inverse again, to convert it to Gaussian integration. I wasn't sufficiently motivated. Mm-hmm. So, okay, I don't think I can do it during a lecture because I spent an hour and got confused. And, you know, sometimes just composing simple mind operations gets you confused, and that was the case, okay? Mm-hmm. It was in Vietnam, it was hot, I don't know, okay? So I can't answer in real time. Mm-hmm. I agree with you that in principle, one should be able to do that. And also, in some sense, I mean, it's good in order to find precedents, to compare it with literature, but it's not, strictly speaking, necessary. And I gave you, I do want to repeat the examples that I mentioned last time, or during Roland's talk, so 2 weeks ago, that I think this is analog to saying that linear algebra is a bit more powerful than to just solve linear equations. So again, you remember what I wrote? I wrote, you know, suppose you wanted to solve the system of equations, e to the y x plus 7 is equal to 3, and y minus 2 is equal to 5. So you solve it in two iterations in which this is a linear algebra problem. You solve it, you figure out why, what y is, you now regard it as a coefficient, as a scalar, or, you know, as a coefficient, and then you solve this problem.
It's certainly a very impressive example, but I don't think it's quite corresponds to what we're actually doing, right?
Well, no, it's an even more simplified version of the same trick. No, I.
Okay, at least maybe let me try to pose a more focused question. It looks like that the key feature is that this two variable enters only once, right? So that's somehow the game maker. What does it mean in terms of integrals? Because I think if you had like this very two thing entering more than once, then I guess probably it would all have diverged. So
yes, no, you're so, right. Yeah, you're right.
So it would be great to know what's the analog of, because right, we already see that the zero variables enter as they want. All right. Now, but the two variable only enters in some very simple, very controlled fashion, and that probably is some condition on the integration, right? There will be some.
No, mm-hmm. I mean, okay. I totally agree with you. Mm-hmm. Some smart people should be looking at this in addition to Roland and mine, on me. And if you will be one of them, it will be great. But I don't know.
But this is exactly the role of epsilon, to make sure that weight two variables don't enter more than once.
Yeah, so I mean,
that's what epsilon does.
Bad things happen in the perturbation. Mm-hmm. Bad things go to the perturbation, yeah. I did want to say something. So, in fact, you can make this sort of split into something much more official. Sorry. The one-man story remains Gaussian integration. I mean, remains kind of Gaussian manipulations throughout. But this story is really a story of changes of variables. Okay? So, in fact, the 0-2 quadratic, if you remember the easy Gaussian. So the easy Gaussians were the Gaussians that corresponded to the the coproduct and the and the product, and so they had to do with things like e to the zeta z1 plus z2 or e to the z1 zeta 1 zeta 1 plus sorry zeta 2 plus zeta 3. So the very simple minded one ones corresponded to just changes of variables, and in some sense the 0-2 part of the story ends up always remains just changes of variables. So really, the effect of doing the Q2-0 integration or zipping is to change variables on this part. I never formalized it. We never wrote it as a completely formal thing, because it is much easier, because then we would have to have two theories that interact instead of one theory that is repeated twice.
I think the kind of basically what you're saying that the one variables they enter at most quadratically, and this is Gaussian integration, and the two variables enter at most linearly, and then this is even in some way simpler. That's what you call change of variable, because if you have an exponential something which is linear, then after that your integration basically leads to the delta function to impose in whatever, some kind of delta function or something, which is a change of variables.
Basically the weight of variables occur linearly because their counterparts are weight zero.
And after that, more or less, weight zero integration is no longer needed, because all weight zero variables that of interest, they will be under delta functions, so their Gaussian, their integration will be an integration of delta of something minus something. If I understand correctly.
Okay. I'm not sure I fully understood you, but okay. Yes, and in a way, okay. Mm-hmm. One reason not to bother to bring this to perfection is because maybe first we need to see what happens with SL3, right? Because then it will be clearer whether we have a ladder of distinct operations or whether it's this it's this pattern repeated twice, or I mean it would be a bit clearer if we knew the general case. We don't. Mm-hmm. Okay? Other questions? But you are right. You're right, that's an uncomfortable point.
Maybe just comment for the precedence, maybe it makes sense at some point to look together at those, in field theory, there are all those bosonization precedents or whatever, bosonization techniques. Maybe at some point informally I can say a couple of words about it, and who knows, maybe it will ring the bell, or maybe not.
Maybe, mm-hmm. I don't know. You know, in a way, if I had asked Witten, he would probably come out with the precedent immediately. Okay. Where were we? So I think I want to. So classical multiplication is Dopezdo. And maybe I will not go through the details, I'll just tell you what comes next. So the next thing is that the R matrix is Dopezdo. And the R matrix, so it has an explicit formula, and basically all you have to do is to show that this formula is Dopezdo. So you have to show that the main issue here is to show that the quantum exponentiation is Dopezdo. And I mean, the answer is you look up classical, or you know, you look up, you sit with the literature sufficiently long. It's not how we came to the answer, but I mean, there's simply an explicit formula which says that by Fadeev for the logarithm of quantum exponential, and which really means that you, which really, so sorry, for the classical logarithm of the quantum exponential. So this really means that you can write the quantum exponential as a classical exponential of something which is written here. And if you look at the thing which is written here and you substitute q is equal to e to the h bar epsilon, which is what it is in our case, then you immediately see that it's Topelian. So basically, you use an existing formula. And I have nothing, I don't have much to say about it. The proof is like five lines, but I have no intuition. It's a proof. It's just five lines of arithmetic. The moment you know that R is Topelio, you are done. Because at this point, you can use the Drinfeld double formula. So the Drinfeld double formula.
So it's the Dopeldo up to any power of epsilon, not only the.
Yeah. It's the Dopeldo throughout. Yes. Mm-hmm. So the moment you know that the R matrix is the Dopeldo, you can. You're done. Because the Drinfeld double formula. So the Drinfeld double formula is a formula for the product of QU from the product of AU and BU, where AU and BU are the two halves, okay, of QU. But AU and BU, their products are the classical products, and they are contained in CU, and CU is already. We've already determined this Dopeldo. Now, the formula that determines the product of QU from AU and BU involves R and the inverse of R, and in fact, the inverse of R in two senses. So, the inverse of R in the kind of compositional sense, which is P, and in the sort of algebraic sense, which is R inverse. But these operations.
What is P?
The pairing. R is okay. So we talked about. So basically, since R is Dopeldo, and all of these operations preserve Dopeldosness, and the Dopeldo is a category, so all compositions you can make out of them are Dopeldo. And in fact, the formula for the quantum multiplication here, it is called double multiplication because it's the double, but really you should be thinking of it as QM. So the formula is just a composition of various operations that it's basically a composition in our universe. So basically that's it. Basically that completes why the quantum algebra is fully Dopeldo.
But wait, you were saying before that for quantum algebra, some of the tricks we saw before don't work. What was that about?
The representation theory trick doesn't work.
Ah, okay.
Instead we use this Fadeev formula, which we would have had to use anyway because you need the R matrix, and the Drinfeld double construction. So, if you go back to.
So you mean in the kind of representation theory here, you kind of there is no easy trick to just make a 2x2 matrix calculation.
Yeah, mm-hmm. It's not a 2x2. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Okay. But what was weight zero is still weight zero, right? Or what? Now, in this, in the quantum kind of the informed series.
Yeah, the weights remain the same.
So the functions change, but the weights remain.
Yes.
Well, actually, you already shown us the results which were included in epsilon, which means that they were already quantum.
No, epsilon is not quantum. Turning epsilon on is not quantization. Quantization is turning H bar on, it's something else. So basically, for the classical multiplication, sorry, I need to find it again. So for the classical multiplication, we had an explicit formula for the, essentially for the kernel. Okay? For quantum multiplication, we don't have an explicit formula.
Very good. So the Alexander polynomial. That's, for that you need epsilon equals zero, but...
Yeah, and for epsilon equals to zero, there is very little difference between quantum and classical. Some normalization is different, but only...
Oh, okay, then it doesn't matter. For the epsilon, you need to turn on quantum, or not? And then if yes, there is...
What does need mean? You can turn on epsilon.
No, but let's say in your answers on the table that you showed to us, those polynomials in red.
Yeah, you needed. Yeah, these were computed using the quantum R matrix.
There is the H in there.
What?
There is the H in there.
The variable T is E to the H.
Yes, I mean, there were several changes of variables before they were written. The H's are hidden.
But it's in the variable as an explanation.
Yeah. No, wait. But there, Alexander is basically classical. And Alexander was a polynomial in the variable T. So there is kind of maybe no H. But then, kind of the next line in red, but just to understand what's going on. So you say the results of this whatever Royston table are quantum results. Are they? Like the kind of.
Yes.
But for Alexander, you can derive them in several ways.
So.
Alexander is the change of variable in the Gaussian integral, so that determinant you get anyway, quantum or classical.
Mm-hmm. Okay, maybe a different way to ask it. For the first order in epsilon, does it make sense to compute it classically? And how will it be different from the quantum part?
Yes, it makes sense to compute it classically.
Mm-hmm.
So, and even for the zeroth order in epsilon. So,
mm-hmm. But for the zeroth order in epsilon, as far as I understand, you're telling us that quantum classically you will get Alexander polynomial up to maybe some overall factor. Is it correct or
yes.
Okay.
No. So. Okay. So. Here's a dirty fact. I mean, so the classical algebra and the quantum algebra are in fact isomorphic. As algebras, okay? Not as co-algebras,
yes.
Okay?
Mm-hmm.
So. Anything you could compute in QU, you could compute in CU. Any products.
Mm-hmm.
So I mean, in computing a not invariant, right? You only need to multiply R matrices, or a tangle invariant. You only need to multiply R matrices.
Yeah, but the R matrix.
So equally well, you could have started from an R from the point. So, in fact, the only advantage of QU, I mean, from this perspective, is the fact that we have a closed form formula for R. In principle, you could take this closed form formula, pull it back to CU, you'll get a formula, well, you get a classical R.
So just translating it back, but it will not be, of course, an R matrix for the Helmholtz.
It will. It will satisfy the same Young-Baxter equation.
Surely not, because now CU is commutative.
No, CU is not commutative.
Oh, okay. But do you decide?
CU is never commutative. Even at epsilon equals to zero, CU is not commutative.
Okay, but then the R matrix will be this kind of funny element, right? That we have in the KV's theory.
No. So there are actually three. So this classical R matrix is actually not the same as, there is a third element, KZR, which is totally different, which is yet another element. So,
What is this CR then?
Well, in the epsilon equal to zero case, in the epsilon equal to zero case, CR is e to the arrow, so the exponential of that, and KZR is e to the.
I meant e to the arrow. Okay, epsilon, or at least on that we agree, CR when epsilon is equal to zero is exponential of the arrow.
Yes. Okay. Oh, okay, yes, sorry. It's not the Keynesian logical
R. Yeah, sure.
Okay, fine. Yes, so this satisfies Young-Baxter. Okay. So, sorry, so now I have to backtrack and remember what was the question that we should be discussing.
Okay, the question is, right, in your final results, I don't understand the role of H. Maybe it's not the right time to ask that question, but I mean, like, in the end, right, we obviously need to know that there are two parameters in your theory, epsilon and h, right, and your answers,
h plays a minor role.
Whatever you say, but kind of in your theory you load h and epsilon, but then, okay, minor role, but what is its role? How the results depend on h, or what? I mean, yeah. So that's a question, not about the techniques, that's a question about results.
So in the first part of the handout, there's this capital T is e to the h bar little t. Capital T is e to the h bar little t. And capital T is actually the variable for the Alexander polynomial. So maybe that helps.
But in the table, in the end, everything.
So then it looks like little t, but it should be capital T. So there is some glitch like that. So right before the quantum leap, it says capital T equals e to the h bar t. The line above the quantum leap.
Sorry, it's this what page?
First page. Second box, I guess. Third box.
Okay. Yes.
And so that capital T, that's the variable that appears in the handout, in the table, except that there it looks like a lowercase, but that should be uppercase.
So all the variables are uppercase T's.
Yes, that's right. So that says something about how H bar enters.
So actually, all the answers in the end, they are quantum answers, and the way how H bar enters is this. All these things are actually exponentials. Okay. But classical answers, if they exist, they're what? H bar equal to zero, that doesn't seem to make
Right, that doesn't make sense, right?
No, because what are the classic, do they exist classical answers, and if they exist, what's the... And you say h-bar expansion, it's not a Vasilian expansion, right? It's what is the h-bar expansion? Sorry for, like, maybe I'm...
No, it's a good question.
I don't know, I'm a bit confused. So, I think what is going on here is that so SL2 plus epsilon really depends on three parameters. Or more precisely, the quantization of this depends on four parameters, three parameters. And the three parameters are epsilon, gamma, where gamma is the dual of epsilon. So, so epsilon has to do with scaling the co-product, the co-bracket, and gamma has to do with scaling the bracket. And h bar. And the reason for our confusion is because maybe that was an unfortunate naming of the parameters, and the quantum h bar that you are used to is some other combination of these. And I'm confused about which one it is.
No, but in quantization of the half, the algebra generated by A and X, that this is the genuine quantization over the power series in H bar, where you make a new co-product on the basis of the co-bracket, where the co-product is now in corrections in H bar. That seems reasonable.
Okay, no. So here's a different way of saying it. So Vasiliev theory is obtained from QU by modding out by some filtration. Okay? But the filtration is not just the powers of H bar. It also, you also mod out by I'm not sure I can do it on my feet, but you also have to look into QU and see what you get. I mean, if you put parameters, then the filtration will also involve gamma and epsilon. So somehow the correspondence with I don't know. I let's leave it unresolved, but there are
Okay, sorry, but I interrupted you when you were about to...
I don't remember what I was going to say.
So you said that we have this R matrix for QU, we have whatever, we use this today as formula to kind of see what is its law, and now...
Yeah, so, no, so basically we can... So in this kind of portfolio of things, I have told you, basically... I told you why this is Dopengdov for both algebras, why this is Dopengdov for both algebras, and basically because the co-product can be interpreted, can be computed using the product and dualities. And since dualities are Dopengdov and the product is Dopengdov, so is the co-product. Likewise for the antipode, so this one I mentioned that is still actually somewhat open. The R matrix is
well, was the Fadeev formula, C plus the cup and the cups and the cups are a whole discussion, but again, the standard way of carrying out this discussion is to derive them from all the other things, and since the derivations are d'Opecto, the result is d'Opecto. And what remains are things like associators, and I...
Maybe one practical question, since you insist on everything being computable. So how, you said that there were no closed formulas in the quantum case, then how do you work with them? So you have a closed formula for the first epsilon correction, or what's the practical way to deal with quantum?
So the quantum so the kernel for quantum multiplication is some composition of tensors that have explicit formulas. And the way the program works, it computes it once and for all. So I mean, if you want it to degree 7, the program will compute it to degree 7. It's actually a difficult computation because it involves lots of compositions, but you compute it once and for all, and then you know it.
Degree in epsilon, or degree in what?
In epsilon.
Okay. But it can, but for up to any degree in epsilon, it can compute it with all the factors of those exponentials of h, so the computer knows the formula.
Yes.
It all comes back to R.
So,
and the formula for R.
Yeah, I mean, I could run it in front of
you. No, just to understand, right?
And again, once you know it, you can use it to compute multiplications. So, you know, there are many.
I think there's still, like, it looks like you're hesitant about what to tell us, but there are still some items
I'll say a few more things, yeah. but then I'll have to. Okay. So, you know, there is the relationship with prior art, right? Mm-hmm. With older work. So, this epsilon expansion should correspond to this Melvin Morton Rosansky expansion, which actually holds only for knots. I mean, so the scope here is much, much, much more limited. But the claim is that the result for knots can be recovered from representation theory by looking at all representations of SL2 and expanding in a certain way. We don't understand it well. We don't understand it at all in a way. So we sort of know it's right because, well, I didn't yet tell you how all of this is related to the loop expansion, but I mean, we know it's right, but we don't understand it very well. And maybe the last, yeah, no, I maybe I'll just, you know, maybe the best if I'll admit that there are many things we don't understand. So, I mean, everything that I've advertised is true. Namely, it really is a polytime computable, not polynomial. It really is stronger than the non-polytime computable invariants that other people are talking about. It really is better in the sense that the whole portfolio is implemented, so not just the invariants, but all the operations leading to them. And then, yes, we're stupid. There are lots of things we still don't know.
Mm-hmm. Like what are the things?
Just so you asked a few. Okay. So. So, you see, in a way I lied to you, right? So I told you that... Let me tell you where there is a gap in what I told you, okay? So I told you that everything is polytime computable, essentially because the space of quadratics, so the rank of the space of quadratics is polynomial. So basically the number of quadratics you have to give, the number of coefficients that quadratic have is roughly n squared. And likewise, if you look at perturbations up to a fixed degree, the rank is, the amount of information is polynomial. It's something like, you know, n to the 2k plus 2 or something like that. Okay? Where k is fixed once and for all, so this is polynomial. But this is the rank over what? This is the rank over the weight zero variables. Okay? Likewise here, this is the rank over the weight zero variables. So it could be that there is a huge amount of information hidden inside the coefficients. The coefficients are not merely scalars, they are power series. So it could be that my arguments for why this is simple were a lie, because there is a lot of information hidden in the coefficients. Okay? Now, we know this is not true. So, and in fact, if you look, I think footnote number 9 states it. So footnote number 9 says that for tangling variants, the weight zero power series are always rational functions in the exponentials of the weight zero variables. And in fact, we can bound the degree. So the degree of the numerators and denominator of these rational functions is bounded by the number of crossings. So we can tell you perfectly well how much information is hidden here, and it's not that much, and it doesn't spoil the polynomiality. Okay? So two things about it. First of all, this is true for tangling variants. I actually totally don't understand what kind of denominators will occur for phi. So what kind of, how to solve?
Why do we care? If you write your target was computing whatever, you're
not if, so if I care so about computing, no. So for the non-theory applications, I don't care. For the not theory applications, everything is fine. But you know, if I want to play Chevrolet games, if I want to play associators game, if I want to verify associators identities in, then I actually don't know what is going on. Mm-hmm. Now, I do have a closed form formula for phi at k equals zero. It's hairy, but it's closed form.
Epsilon equals zero.
Sorry.
So
k equals zero and epsilon equals to zero is the same.
Okay.
Okay, good. So, k is the power of epsilon. So, so at epsilon equals to zero, I have closed form formulas for phi.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, they are hairy, but they are... but they're closed form, so I sort of know that there will be bounds on the coefficients even when you include associators, but I don't know what they are. Okay, and now to be even more honest, okay, so I told you that for tangles, or footnote 9 tells you that for tangles, the coefficients look like rational functions. Okay? The denominators I somehow don't understand the denominators. So I could explain in what sense. So you see.
Well, you still have bounds on their degree, right?
Yeah, I have bounds on their degree, but I don't understand them. Mm-hmm. And here's how it comes about. So. You know, suppose you want to compute the invariant of the of some complicated knot. Okay? So basically you chop it to pieces. I mean, really the pieces can go over each other, right? But you chop it to pieces and you multiply, you multiply, you multiply, you multiply. Okay? So, you know, you get the invariant of like longer first pieces. You know, you get fewer and fewer pieces until eventually you get the whole knot. Okay? Now, our formalism, you know, so in each step, you need to do some Gaussian integrations or Gaussian compositions, Gaussian zipping. Okay? But you could do them all at once at the end. Okay? So you could compute straight from here to here. And this bounds the denominator because this has no denominators or understand or fully understandable denominators. And the Gaussian formula involves inverting a single n by n matrix, so you know exactly what the denominators are going to be. So you can bound get bounds on the denominators here. So you can get a priori bounds on the denominators that will occur at the end. Okay? I still don't know how to get these bounds in an inductive way. So, I can tell you, likewise I can tell you what will be the bound of the denominators here, because I could get to this step straight from here. But I don't know why is it that if you have bounded denominators here, then and then you do the one last gluing step, you get the correct bound here.
So the bounds you get straight away are better bounds, right? Than the bounds you get inductively. Is it the case?
I don't have inductive bounds.
But a priori, yes.
So the a priori bound is way better than the inductive one.
Okay.
Yeah.
So.
Why does it matter?
Yeah,
it matters because the efficient way to do computations is to actually do them step by step. But since I don't know what rational functions, okay. If I knew in advance that all my rational functions have the same denominator, I could pull this denominator out of the computations and end up computing only with polynomials. And then things would be way faster. But I don't know how to do that. So we're forced to kind of... We just don't know what to do. I don't know if this sounded exciting. This doesn't sound exciting, but it sounds like a technicality, but it's a technicality that makes our programs run much slower than they should. Then there is, so I somewhat lied to you, so I told you that, if you read the handout carefully, there are no lies. There is a statement saying that the program is actually don't entirely match the theory. So the theory is that we would use perturbation theory to go from to compute. Sorry, we would use Feynman diagrams to compute compositions at the perturbation level. And strictly speaking, since the perturbation is in the exponent, these are connected Feynman diagrams. The programs actually exponentiates the perturbation, and then uses the analog of not necessarily connected Feynman diagrams, which is way, 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 way slower. But I just don't know how to. My computer skills are insufficient. I just don't know how to do it cleanly and elegantly. So I mean, we're missing huge factors of efficiency, and we don't know how to do it. Yeah, I don't know. Maybe we should stop. But. Maybe this was very disappointing, but I it's very disappointing for me. Maybe you should turn off the.
Maybe some questions, or should we just
stop? No, we've had too many questions.
Questions are
unanswered.
Okay, let's thank Brewer again then.